Archer. Good morning. Man, so good to see you guys. My name is Chuck Eastman, if you haven't met me. And, you know, are you guys excited about some football this afternoon? Yeah. You know, as many of you know, as a Chiefs fan, it's the first time in like a decade I'm not nervous. It's the first season, first playoff run, like I can eat nachos and hang out and no anxiety, you know? Just watch you guys. I am rooting for the Niners since my guys are out of it. So, the Lord is using this season to humble me, change me, bring some sanctification into my life. Man, go Niners, though. You know, what an exciting season for our church. You know, as you heard during the announcements, there's so many ways to find a place to belong. Whether it's men's ministry, Better Man, it's just fire. It's such an amazing opportunity to get around and just share life. Marriage ministry, multiple opportunities. Listen, we get reports all the time of people saying, hey, my marriage was really struggling, and the community in these marriage classes really helped. And so, you know, just look for those. There's tables back there for that. There's just so many ways to get connected. It's a big room, but we're a family, and so make sure that you take the opportunity to drill down and find a crew of people to do life with. You know, we are in the Gospel of Mark. We've been working through it chapter by chapter, and today we come to a section in chapter 9. That's a really difficult section, to be honest, on the front end. It's a difficult section, and it's considered to be one of the hard sayings of Jesus, and some say it's one of the most difficult things Jesus taught. In terms of getting your mind around it, and definitely trying to get your heart around what he said. You know, as I was thinking about the passage, I was thinking about a situation that happened a while back, 2003. A guy named Aaron Ralston was climbing in Utah. He was in a big canyon, and he was climbing. He's a pretty experienced climber, but he slipped and he fell, and just the way he fell, a boulder fell and trapped his wrist and his forearm against the ground. And so his rest of his body was free, but his wrist and his forearm was trapped against the ground. In fact, he wrote a book called Caught Between a Rock and a Hard Place. And he was stuck there. And I think initially, you know, there's a movie out there, by the way, that's kind of difficult to watch. It's called 127 Hours. But he was stuck there. And I think initially he was like, hey, you know, I'll wiggle it out, you know, and I'll get it out of this boulder. Or maybe the boulder will shift a little bit. Or, you know, maybe I can just get an inch free to get it free. And he wrestled with it for a while and couldn't get it free. And maybe he thought, you know, I think some other hikers will come around. And so he endured the first night, got down to freezing temperatures, and it was really difficult, and he was really suffering, and he went another night, and he was trapped there for hours until it finally hit him that he was gonna die in that canyon. And so he did, and what I'm gonna tell you next, that, if you get nauseous easy, but he broke his arm above where the boulder was, and he got his pocket knife out, and he cut off his arm below the elbow. And it took him hours, actually. It wasn't like a nice, clean, you know, surgical knife thing. He had to kind of work at it. And he finally cut it off, and he actually knew how to do a tourniquet, so he did a tourniquet right below his elbow, and he crawled out of that canyon, and he survived. And this passage, actually, is gonna talk about drastic measures. Jesus is going to talk about a series of drastic action that he's going to do and that he's calling those who follow him to do. And so we have to kind of gear up, I think, this morning to say, hey, are we in on following Jesus? Because what Jesus teaches and says, what he demonstrates with his life, we're going to find out this morning, it isn't that easy. In fact, it might even scare us a little bit. Check out how the narrative gets going this morning. If you have a blue Bible in front of you, we're in chapter 9. We're starting in verse 30. I forgot to see what page it was, but I'm sure one of your neighbors can tell you where the page is. Verse 30. They, Jesus and his disciples, went on from there. We don't know exactly. Somewhere outside of Galilee. and they passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples. In other words, he didn't want the crowds to follow because he was trying to have some time with his disciples to really download to them who he was and what the mission was all about. And he was saying to them, the Son of Man, that is a reference to being the Messiah, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. It's pretty drastic. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. They were like, what? Like, what's going on with this? We know you're the Son of Man, but like, what's, you know, this? You're gonna get killed, and you're gonna rise, and that seems complicated. I don't really understand that. So they kept walking, verse 33, and they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing along the way? Now, you and I, who don't know what other people are talking about, if it was me in that moment, I might ask that question. If I just shared with you that, hey, I'm gonna die, and then along the way, you didn't really ask me any questions about it, but I'm trying to explain it to you, and then you guys start to talk amongst yourself, I might think that you were trying to grapple with this difficult idea that I'm gonna die, that your follower is gonna be killed. Guess again. And that's not what they're talking about. And like a bad student, they kept silent. For on the way, they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. Huh? What? Yeah, I'm, guys, and the Son of Man's gonna be killed, and he's gonna be delivered, what do you guys think about that? And they're like, well, I don't know. And then they're talking, and what were you talking about? Well, we just wondered who was gonna be second chair in heaven. We just wondered who's gonna be the greatest. You know, obviously you chose us because we're awesome Jewish boys and we're incredible. We don't know why we're incredible, but we must have been incredible because you chose us. And we're just wondering among us who's gonna be the greatest. I don't know about you, but if my friend came to me and was like, hey, you know, I just want you to know I'm probably gonna die soon. I don't know if the thing I'm concerned about is like, hey, do I get your stuff or anything? You know, like when you go, like, can I get your car? You know, some of you guys have cars that I want, you know? And that's kind of their mindset around here. And we run into the first big idea this morning, which is the death of Jesus makes no sense when I think I'm basically a good person. I think I'm doing pretty good. If I think I'm in the running for who's the greatest, then the death of Jesus kind of makes no sense to me. Like, you know, talking about dying and later they're gonna actually see that it's a cross and how humiliating the cross is. And if you're basically a good person, you're looking at that and you're going like, that's nonsensical. It makes no sense to me. Who needs that? I definitely don't need that. And a slightly different idea, self-reliant, self-righteous, and self-assured, self-promoting people, you have little use for the cross. If I can fix it, if I can fix whatever's going on in my family, the dynamics that are not going well, my children, or if I can fix the stuff at work, or if I can fix this anger problem inside, or this little drinking problem I've got over here, if I can get all that kind of navigated myself, then who needs the cross? In fact, the cross for self-reliant people is, it's actually weak. That's what weak, poor people need. But I don't need that. I've got this. And that's kind of where the disciples are. And Jesus has to kind of flip their worldview. Check out verse 35. And so he sat down and he called the 12 and he said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be the last of all and the servant of all. Again, this is going completely against their worldview. They're thinking, I got chosen by the Messiah to be the greatest, to be the ones who get to rule and reign. And when Rome gets kicked out, we're gonna be like, you're obviously the king, but we're like top generals. And Jesus is totally flipping their worldview. In fact, what he seems to be saying to them is that the way of Jesus is a life where selfish ambition is laid down for the good of others. And this is not the way they've seen their mission. The Apostle Paul actually picks up on this idea of this cross and this life of laying down your life to be a servant. And he says in Philippians chapter 2, Do nothing, this is you and I, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but to the interests of others. Have this mind or this thinking among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. Though he was in the form of God, he didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men and being found in a human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Jesus is trying to make this connection for his disciples, that the mission of Jesus was to die, to lay his life on the cross, and that as they see him and they find him beautiful, the way of Jesus is to lay down their lives as well. And this is a major worldview shift for them. And he wants to see that the reason this is the case is because the way of Jesus embraces the powerless. This cross in this life of, you know, you were first, but you became last, and you came to serve others. The outflow of that is that the way of Jesus embraces the powerless. Look at verse 36. And he took a child. This is in the context of being the servant of all. And he took a child, and he put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Now, a child, now he had a physical child, but like for many things, this is an illustration because the child represents being small, being vulnerable, and being powerless. And Jesus is trying to say that the death that he's talking about, trying to get them to understand, is a death that's leveraged for the small, the weak, the vulnerable, and the powerless. And that the way of Jesus for those who follow him is to say, I'm going to give my life for the small, the weak, the vulnerable, and the powerless. That's the child. And yet, like I think me and maybe some of you other hard-headed people, the disciples don't really get it. Look at verse 38. And Jesus said to him, or John said to him, teacher, and again, this is the context of receiving the child, teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name and we tried to stop him because he was not following us. But Jesus said, do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will be able to afterwards to speak evil of me. For the one who is not against us is for us. For truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward. What are the disciples doing? They're still not tracking with Jesus, are they? Jesus goes, man, I'm gonna lay my life down. They go, well, who's the greatest? Like, are we having two different conversations, guys? And then he says, you know, here's a child, and I want you to embrace this powerless, weak child. That's what the mission is all about. And they go, yeah, you know, we heard that there's these other guys, and they're talking about you, and they're using your name, and they're casting out demons. And because they're not part of our crew, can we tell them to stop? He goes, what are we talking about here? But I think we actually bump into something underneath the surface that's probably true for so many of us. Is that self-righteous, or you can insert the self-righteous, self-reliant, self-assured people are primarily concerned with maintaining control and power. See, the disciples aren't thinking mission yet. They're not thinking what Jesus really came to do yet. They're saying, hey, there's these other people and they're doing good things, but they're not part of us, which means if they step out and they serve in that way, we're losing control and power. And I think underneath the surface for so many people, so many of us, that the thing that's really between us and Jesus is my sense of control. I'm trying to keep my grip on everything. I'm trying to promote myself still. And Jesus has to deal with that. In fact, what he wants them to know really is that his way, his life, his message isn't just about getting a good life. It's not about winning. It's not about power. But actually what hangs in the balance, Jesus wants them and us to know, is eternity. Heaven and hell is waiting in the balance. And check out what he says in verse 42. For whoever causes one of these little ones, and this is the children, the child in the middle, whoever believes in or causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone was hung around his neck and he was thrown into the sea. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life crippled than with two hands than to go to hell, to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than with two feet to be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes and to be thrown into hell, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Wow. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you've been in church your whole life and you've been all in following Jesus for 20 years. Maybe you're like a new Christian and you're like, hey, I've just been doing this for a few years, but you know, I love church and I love Jesus and this is really changing my life. Or maybe you're here and you're just like curious and you're checking it out and the music's been really good and you're like, hey, there's people here I really like and so I'm kind of checking it out. I don't care where you land this morning, what we just read should stun us. It should slow us all down. It's heavy. It's hard. It's emotionally unsettling a little bit. Why? What is Jesus talking about? Why, in this conversation of his death and this conversation of laying down his life and them laying their life down and embracing the powerless, why in that context is this teaching about sin and hell, why does it move into center stage? And I think the first thing we need to notice is that Jesus wants to elevate our sensitivity to the devastating weight of sin. Jesus is trying to create a sensitivity in us that may not exist to say sin has an incredible ability to wreck our lives and to wreck everyone around us. And for many of us, and I would say even for those of us who follow Jesus and for maybe people who are just curious looking in, I think many of us have the common problem of minimizing our sin or being too comfortable with our sin. You know, I used to laugh at my mom back in the day. I have a great godly mom. She grew up as a missionary kid in Japan. And then she had 6 kids, 4 boys. And I just remember in high school, you know, my mom would be so sensitive to movies, you know. And so, you know, we'd have to talk to her. Like, Mom, can we watch this movie? And we've done the reviews and it's only got 4 cuss words, you know, and they only kiss. There's no, you know, sex. Or, you know, my mom would be like, I don't know, you know. But we'd try to twist her arm, you know. And I remember one time we went to a movie, and I think it was me. I talked our family into going to this movie. It's like an action movie, and I looked it up, and, you know, they only say the F word a few times, and, you know, and all this different stuff. And we're in the movie, and I just remember being so embarrassed at the time, but I'm like, man. And I just remember, like, we're watching the movie, and all of a sudden there's a scene, and the guy just uses the F word. And my mom goes, whoa! And we're in a packed theater. I'm like, Mom, shh. And then we're going 6-7 minutes later, and somebody else uses the F word. My mom's like, whoa, hey. I'm like, Mom, she did that the 6 times they used the F word in that movie, okay? You're so sensitive to, like, well, that's devastating. Oh, they're cursing God. Are we really gonna? And she, I mean, my mom would do this. She goes, they just curse God. Are we really gonna stay here? Just so sensitive. And I used to laugh at that. I used to make fun of that until I read the words of Jesus. And he seems to want to elevate this sensitivity. Sin is devastating. Sin is destroying us and destroying everyone around us. So much so that he's like, if you could cut your hand off to stop sinning, it would be worth it. Now, that's obviously a metaphor. but he's trying to give violent image to the way sin is destroying our lives. I think the second thing he's throwing out at us is that sin isn't somewhere apart from us. It's not out there. It's not just a big bad world. It's not just a big culture out there. It's not like, you know, all the bad things are going. It's not out there. It's in here. Or maybe you've been in church for a while and you've learned some language, and here's the language you've learned. You've learned it. It's attack. Now I believe in spiritual attack. I believe in the powers of darkness and demonic attack. But I think sometimes we can go, oh man, I'm under spiritual attack. There's demonic attack coming at me. But what's really going on is there is deep, selfish sin we haven't let go of. Sin isn't out there somewhere. It is working inside of us. James, the half-brother of Jesus, I think had a good understanding of what Jesus was getting at with his anthropology. And look what he says in James chapter 4. He says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and don't receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. Sin is not just out there somewhere. It's an internal disease that is causing wreckage in our heart, and it's working its way out into every relationship that we have. And so, that brings us to a reality that I think is really heavy for a lot of us. Sin, Jesus seems to be saying, and the refusal to let go of it leads to fair and just judgment. And this is the part, as an American and as a Christian in America, this part is hard for me, but I don't want to apologize for Jesus. Jesus seems to be saying that sin is so devastating that if we don't let go of it, if we love it, it leads to fair and just judgment. And then we begin to see, what is that judgment like? And I sometimes wish Jesus didn't explain it or describe it, but he does. And maybe right before we get into the things that he said, I think there's a things we have to kind of grapple with. And there's lots of mystery around what hell is and its nature and what kind of punishment is it. And there's so many questions around it. But I think for a lot of us, the questions actually boil down to two very simple questions. The first question is this account an accurate historical account of the real teachings of Jesus? Do we have in these pages a real historical account of the real Jesus who lived on planet Earth 2,000 years ago? Now, that's a subject that's really deep and you can dive into it, but I think if you do, you're gonna find that we have incredible evidence that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John give us the real words of Jesus. It's accurate and it's historical. The second question I think we have to grapple with is, who is Jesus to us? Is Jesus, as he claims to be, the Messiah? Is he really the God who became man and entered into history and lived a perfect life and died on the cross for our sins and rose again? Is that the Jesus who says these words? Because there may be a lot of mystery around what it is and what it means, but at the end of the day, they come out of the heart and the mind of Jesus. And if he's the Messiah, if he's the King, then I'm either gonna embrace him and all that he is and all that he says, or I'm gonna reject him. But I don't get to take parts and bits and pieces of who he is. And so here he is, and he says three things about hell. He says that hell is real and worse than we can imagine, because sin is real and more devastating than we want to admit. Now, Jesus talks a lot about hell and throughout the Gospels, and in this case, he's talking about fire. In another case, in Matthew chapter 8, he talks about utter darkness. And so fire and darkness are probably metaphorical. In other words, it's probably not a place of literal fire and literal darkness. But think about it. Metaphors always point to something bigger. So even if it's not literal fire and literal darkness, they probably point to a real and more horrible and painful than we can imagine, because sin is real and more devastating than we want to admit. The second thing is that hell is separation from all the goodness and beauty of God. Jesus here talks about Gehenna. Gehenna is the Greek word for the trash dump outside of the city. And so there was this place, there was this fire outside of the city, and it's where you went and threw your trash. It was called Gehenna. And it was also the place that if you were a family that couldn't afford a burial, if your loved ones passed away, you would go put them on that fire. And what would happen is on that fire, as the fire was burning all of the trash, worms or maggots would eat whatever was eatable in that fire until they'd eaten it all and the fire consumed it all, and then the worms would die. And Jesus is describing a place that has no goodness to it, no beauty to it. And he's describing that hell is an eternal punishment. Hell is an eternal punishment. Look at what he says in verse 43 and 48 again. He says, it's better for you to enter life crippled than with two hands to go to hell, to the unquenchable fire. Or verse 48, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. There seems to be this lack of goodness, lack of beauty, but an eternalness to the punishment. Again, this isn't the only place Jesus talked about this. In Matthew 25, Jesus actually picks this up again. Matthew 25 describes the final judgment where he gathers the world and the nations back to himself, and he's looking at them, and he describes them as sheep and goats. Sheep are people who've put their confidence in Jesus, love Jesus, follow Jesus, and goats are people that have rejected Jesus, and he lays out in front of them these words. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me. That's the separation from the goodness and the beauty of God. Depart from me, you cursed, into eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angel. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you didn't welcome me. Naked and you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison and you didn't visit me. And they will also answer saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? And he will answer them saying, truly I say to you, as you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. We are eternal souls. We're created with eternity. We're living in eternal space now. We have a physical body, but we are eternal beings living right now, and there is an eternal destination for everyone. That's heavy. We have to sit in that for a minute. And our mind might have all kinds of objections to those realities. But this is what Jesus is saying. I think the last, and I think maybe the most helpful thing in all of this, though, that Jesus points out is that hell is freely chosen. Hell is freely chosen. If you looked at that passage, he's talking about your hand. He's saying, your hand wants to do this, but you can fight against what it wants. Your eyes, they lead you to what you want, what you fantasize about, but you can fight against that. Your feet, they take you where you want to go, but you can fight against it. C.S. Lewis used to say that hell is locked on the inside. That hell is the trajectory of God giving us everything we've wanted in our life. And if what we've wanted is ourselves, our stuff, our comfort, our money. How will be the full giving of all that we've actually pursued and wanted? I love what theologian J.I. Packard says when he says that Scripture sees hell as self-chosen. Hell appears as God's gesture of respect for human choice. All receive what they actually choose, either to be with God forever, worshiping Him, or without God forever, worshiping themselves. It's freely chosen. It's God honoring our free will to have what we actually want. And listen, hell will always offend us until we see how devastating our sin is and how perfect, just, and holy Jesus is. Hell will always offend us until we see that lying wrecks our soul and destroys every relationship around us. It will always offend us until we see that when we look at Jesus, who's perfect and holy and amazing, that we're not the standard anymore. That our good efforts are not the standard, that God's looking at us and saying, hey, you're all right, because you're better than Billy, but you know, maybe Johnny's a little better than you, but it's all right. It only makes sense when we get Jesus in view and we go, oh, that's the standard. Holy, perfect, loving, and self-giving in every way possible. And that's not me. As long as we think that somehow somebody in this room or somebody we can idealize and look at and we say, well, that person's the standard, hell will offend us. See, Jesus is trying to say, this is love, the one, the servant who lays down his life, and here you are. Well, who's the greatest? Here's the child, fight for the powerless. Yeah, but I want to be in control. Hell will always offend us until we see how devastating our sin is and how perfect, just, and holy Jesus is. But once we do, we can realize that hell vividly highlights the perfect love of God in Jesus, who endured the cross to bring us freedom. See, remember, if you're over here fighting, discussing about who's the greatest, the cross means nothing. But when you realize that you and I are the powerless, when you and I realize we're the vulnerable, when we realize we're the ones whose sin is wrecking us, and it's not the culture out there. We are the culture. We're creating the culture. We're our lives and our sin is destroying everything around us. And Jesus went to the cross on my behalf to embrace me as the poor and the vulnerable. When that happens, we'll say the cross was the place where God demonstrated perfect love and perfect justice, because he dealt with sin and said, it is finished. See, Jesus is the greatest, and yet he became the servant of all. And he picked up his cross to put sin in the grave so that you and I could by faith be free and fight sin. See, this whole war on sin, that's not possible until Jesus brings freedom into your soul. But once he does, oh, he gives us a strength and a power and a freedom to say, yes, this may be at work, but Jesus died on the cross, and I can say no. I can take radical measures to fight against addiction and selfishness and pride. And I can press in and find the freedom that comes from what Jesus has done on my behalf. So here's what we're gonna do, Venture. We're gonna take the elements, and we're gonna take the table together, and we're gonna contemplate this life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, where that his body and his blood represented for us. And while we do that, we're gonna play a song. It's a confession, really. And we don't want anybody to stand up. We just want you to hold the elements and make this confession your confession. to say, God, I want to see me clearly, and I want to see you in all of your beauty. So sit, receive. If you want to sing it as a confession, feel free. And then we're going to take the table together as the song closes.